Two films, one theme. This is Words and Movies.
Dankeschön, Rebecca, and welcome to yet another episode of Words and Movies. I'm your co-host, Claude Colt.
And I'm your other co-host, Sean Gallagher. And we're continuing our Around the World series that we've been doing. And today, as you might have inferred from Claude's introduction, we're going to be going to Germany. Now, well, figuratively speaking, anyway.
Yeah.
Now, Claude, I don't know if you saw for the past year or so on Facebook, there's been a meme slash post that's been going around that's been saying roughly while there is a very vocal group in America that does not want its children to be learning about any quote-unquote bad things that might have happened in United States history. In Germany, on the other hand, children are being taught what is unarguably the worst thing that ever happened in German history, and that is the Holocaust. Now, there have been a number of movies in Germany and outside of Germany that have also confronted the Holocaust, but that's not the only part of Germany's checkered past that has been dealt with in German movies. And today we're going to look at two movies talking about unsavory events in Germany's past or unsavory elements. From 2006, The Lives of Others, written and directed by Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck. And from 2008, The Baader-Meinhof Complex, directed by Yuli Edel. Both of these movies, in addition to confronting parts of Germany's past, are period pieces. They were both nominated for what was then known as Best Foreign Language Film, now called Best Non-English Language Film, at the Oscars the year they came out. The Lives of Others actually won that award. Both movies share a couple of actors, and the directors used similar approaches in filming these subjects. And we're going to get to that when we get further into discussing them. But first, Claude is going to give us the plot description for The Lives of Others.
I sure am. It is 1984, and we're in East Berlin, and we get some alternating scenes between an interrogation and a training class for aspiring officers of the Stasi, or the secret police. Stasi Captain Gerd Wiesler is demonstrating his interrogation technique using audio tape of his own interrogation of a suspect. Wiesler instructs the students on how to tell whether a subject is lying. A student asks a question that he judges maybe a little bit too compassionate, and the professor marks the student's name on the attendance record, suggesting that this student is not likely to pass the class. We see that Wiesler is a highly skilled officer of the Stasi. He is a proud, disciplined, and entirely cold-blooded professional, and he's convinced that his efforts are building a better socialist society. At the end of the class, Lieutenant Colonel Anton Grubitz, who is Wiesler's old school friend, and he's now the head of the culture department at Stasi, he comes by to invite Wiesler to a theatrical premiere. The play is by the celebrated East German playwright Georg Dreimann, and its leading character is played by Dreimann's lover, Christina Maria Seeland, an actress of great reputation. Dreimann, who writes plays about the heroic proletariat, lives a rather comfortable life in a plush East Berlin apartment, enjoying a certain notoriety among DDR officials who value him because he's one of the few East Germans whose work is known in the West. He manages to maintain the respect of the artistic community by using his relatively secure position for occasional interventions in favor of dissident fellow artists. Wiesler at once suspects that Dreimann's loyalty to the party is not as strong as it would seem on the surface, even if the higher party officials are convinced. Following the performance, Grubitz has a brief conversation about Dreimann with the culture minister, Bruno Hempf, who is also in attendance. Hempf is attracted to the leading lady. However, since Dreiman is in the way, he must somehow be eliminated. Hempf, who happens also to be a member of the Central Committee, which has authority over the Stasi, tells Grubitz about his reservations, quote-unquote, regarding the playwright's loyalty to the Socialist Unity Party, and he suggests full-scale surveillance of Dreiman. Grubitz, who is looking to increase his own political capital, asks Wiesler to manage this task, which is codenamed Laszlo. Soon after, Hempf meets Dreiman and Seeland at a party and in a rather unsubtle way lets Christa Maria know of his feelings toward her. He also gives Dreiman a tough time about his naive belief expressed in his plays that people change. Hempf is convinced people never change. For a couple of days, Wiesler stalks Dreiman, noting his comings and goings, and while the playwright is away, he has Dreiman's apartment systematically bugged. As the bugging team leaves the apartment, Wiesler notices that a neighbor is watching them through the peephole in her door. He knocks and tells the neighbor if she tells anyone what she saw, her daughter will lose her place at university. Wiesler sets up his surveillance headquarters in the attic just above the apartment. As Dreiman and Seeland prepare for a party in his apartment to celebrate Dreiman's 40th birthday, Seeland gives him a necktie and reminds him that he promised to wear it. She wonders if he knows how to tie it. He says, "Of course I can," but of course he can't. So he sneaks across the hall to knock on the neighbor's door so he can ask her to tie it for him. She comes into his apartment and she ties the tie, but she's so nervous that Dreiman asks whether she's sick, but of course she can't tell him what's the matter. The neighbor goes home, and Christa Maria, who never saw the neighbor, is none the wiser and a little bit impressed at his ability. At the party, Dreiman's close friend, theater director Albert Yerska, is shunned by the other guests, but because Yerska has been blacklisted for his anti-government opinions, he hasn't been able to work for years, and now people are afraid to be seen talking to him. Yerska's birthday gift to Dreiman turns out to be sheet music for a work called Sonata for a Good Man. In a lunchtime scene at Stasi headquarters, the young agent starts to tell a joke about SED leader Erich Honecker. He's overheard, and he's forced to finish the joke by Grubitz, who then threatens to have him transferred to the most low-level, soul-crushingly boring job available, and finally says, "I was just kidding." Soon, Wiesler's observations indicate that, contrary to his prejudices toward artists as free thinkers, Dreiman's attitude toward the DDR and its SED is not particularly scornful. In the meantime, Christa Maria has been convinced him by Minister Hempf to be receptive to his advances, and when Wiesler finds out about this, it starts to dawn on him that maybe Operation Laszlo has a little bit more to do with the minister than with the nation's security. At one point, Wiesler makes Dreiman's doorbell ring in order to draw him down to the street-level door just in time to see the minister drop Seeland off and tell her when she must meet him again. Dreiman is provoked to take action by the awareness of his lover's coerced sexual relationship with the minister and the suicide of Yerska. After learning of Yerska's death, Dreiman sits at his piano and he plays the piece Yerska gave him, which I'll remind you is called the Sonata for a Good Man. Wiesler, listening in the attic, is actually moved to tears by the music. Christa Maria comes in, and Dreiman quotes Lenin, saying if he kept listening to Beethoven's Appassionata, he'd never have finished the revolution. Then he asks, can anyone who has heard this music, I mean truly heard it, really be a bad person? In the following scene, a small child in an elevator asks Wiesler if he's really with the Stasi and says that his father says Stasi agents are bad men who put people in prison. Wiesler starts to ask the boy his father's name, but stops himself. We get a glimpse of Wiesler's empty life. He apparently has no family, and it's in a scene involving a prostitute. After sex, he asks her to stay a little while, but she has another appointment, saying he needs to reserve any extra time he wants in advance, and she leaves him alone. Dreiman resolves to help reveal the true face of the DDR government to the outside world. With the help of some well-positioned West Germans who provide him with a typewriter that can't be traced back to him, he plans to publish an anonymous exposé in one of the leading West German weekly magazines, Der Spiegel. The article concerns the DDR's government cover-up of the high suicide rate in East Germany. Based on Dreiman's research, the government stopped collecting suicide statistics in 1977, at which time East Germany's suicide rate was higher than that of any other country except for Hungary. As they work on the article, Dreiman's friends worry about being overheard. Dreiman is sure his apartment isn't bugged, but his friends suspect otherwise, so they concoct a test. A contact in West Germany comes to visit his apartment, and they openly discuss his plans to return to West Germany with his son, an East German citizen, hidden under the seat of his car. They described the car, a gold Mercedes, and the intended route, and then announced their departure. Wiesler hears everything but decides not to tip off the border guards. When the car makes it across the border, Dreiman and his friends conclude that his apartment is safe and unbugged. Wiesler is hard enough to know by now to know that Dreiman is writing something that will be smuggled out for publication in West Germany. He's in a position to provide a victory to the DDR and a feather in his own professional cap by foiling the plot. However, Wiesler is starting to waver in his determination to bring Operation Laszlo to its conclusion. In the process of snooping in his victims' everyday lives, including their love lives, he has unconsciously been drawn into their world, and that has put his own in question. At one point, he approaches Christa Maria in a cafe to tell her how much he admires her work. She replies, "He's a good man." He does not tell her his name. Wiesler returns to the surveillance post where he learns that Christa Maria did in fact return home to Dreiman, skipping her appointment with the minister, and that she won't see the minister again. When the article is finally published in Der Spiegel, it is a public disaster for the DDR, and the playwright becomes a prime suspect. Grubitz is incredulous that with all his expertise, Wiesler could have missed the indications that Dreiman was writing the article. And Wiesler, like Dreiman, has relied on the cover story that he's writing a play in honor of the DDR's 40th anniversary. Minister Hempf uses Christa Maria's drug addiction as an excuse to have her arrested, and he threatens to terminate her acting career unless she collaborates with the authorities and denounces her lover as the author of the embarrassing article, which she eventually does. The Stasi searches Dreiman's apartment, but they come up empty-handed. Now, Wiesler, who has withheld evidence concerning the source of the article, has to decide where his allegiance is, with the DDR and his career as a top Stasi officer, or with Dreiman and Christa Maria, whose lives he has come to appreciate. In a tense scene, he sits in an interrogation room as Christa Maria is brought in, knowing she's going to recognize him from the cafe, and knowing also that Grubitz is watching through the one-way glass. But Christa Maria is too good an actress to give everything away. Wiesler offers her a choice: never work in the theater again, or become an informant and tell him where Dreiman has hidden the typewriter that he used to write the suicide article. He tells her they already have enough evidence to put him in jail, so there's nothing she can do for him, but she can save herself and hide her involvement with the Stasi. She agrees, miserably. Christa Maria comes home and she feeds Dreiman a line about being away in the country. She's in the shower when the Stasi team arrives, and she emerges in her bathrobe just in time to see Grubitz start to pry up the floorboard where the typewriter is stashed. She makes brief eye contact with Dreiman, who knows she must have told them where to look. She leaves the house before Grubitz can get the board up to reveal nothing. When she reaches the street, Christa Maria steps deliberately into the path of a truck and is fatally struck. Wiesler speaks to her briefly as she lies bleeding in the end, but steps away as Dreiman embraces her and apologizes. He believes that she removed the typewriter. She dies. Grubitz, who actually seems a little bit ashamed, calls off the investigation. However, he tells Wiesler that although Wiesler was clever enough to leave no tracks, Grubitz knows he covered for Dreiman somehow. Grubitz assures Wiesler that he will spend the remaining 20 years of his career steaming open the correspondence of his fellow citizens in a dank Stasi basement. About 5 years later, Wiesler is indeed steaming letters open in a basement office. A colleague behind him is listening to the radio, and if you'll pay attention, you'll notice it's the same young officer who got in trouble for telling the joke earlier. The young officer hears on the radio that the Berlin Wall has fallen and shares his earpiece so that Wiesler can listen too. When Wiesler just gets up and walks out of the Stasi office, the other workers follow him. 2 years later, Dreiman runs into ex-minister Hempf, who appears to have survived the political upheaval rather well, and asks him why his apartment was never bugged. Hempf assures Dreiman his home was thoroughly bugged and suggests that he look behind the light switches. Dreiman does so and then visits the Stasi archives, which have been made public. He's a little bit horrified to discover that the records of Operation Laszlo are pretty huge, and while reading through them, he discovers gaps covering evidence that would have been damning, along with beneficial misinformation, all attributed to a Stasi agent identified as HGWXX/7. He also learns that Christa Maria was released from custody too late to have extracted the typewriter from its hiding place, and he notices a red fingerprint on one of the pages, left there by an agent who must have handled the mysteriously missing typewriter with its distinctive red ribbon. The file's final entry notes the transfer and demotion of HGWXX/7, who is blamed for the failure of the operation. Dreiman looks up HGWXX/7's real name and tracks down Wiesler, who now delivers mail for a living, but doesn't speak to him. Fast forward another 2 years. Wiesler walks past a bookstore advertising a new release with huge posters of the author's face. The book, billed as a novel, is titled Sonata for a Good Man, and the author is Georg Dreyman. Wiesler goes inside, opens a copy, and reads the dedication to HGWXX/7 in gratitude. At the checkout counter, the clerk asks whether he should gift wrap the book, and Wiesler replies, "No, it's for me."
Now, this should go without saying, but in this day and age, I'm going to have to say it. Forgive me, I have to get on the soapbox for a little bit. It is possible to find fault with our capitalist system of government and think that there is plenty of room for improvement and still be able to recognize that communism, particularly the brand practiced by the Soviet Union for about seven decades from 1917 up through 1990, as well as the Eastern Bloc countries after World War II and China after World War II, among other places, was not a viable alternative to our current flawed system of government. Now, as I said, that should go without saying, but for a lot of people, apparently that's not apparent, which may explain why most, at least in this country, most of the anti-communist movies that were made were pretty much nothing more than right-wing fantasies, right-wing harangues or whatever. And I know some people would say, but what about Pick Up on South Street, Samuel Fuller's film? And while that certainly has virtues, including what may be Thelma Ritter's best performance, and that's saying a lot, by the way,
yeah.
I feel it doesn't quite escape that trap. And the handful of good anti-communist movies made in this country, and I'm thinking of movies like Ninotchka, directed by Ernst Lubitsch, 1-2-3, directed by Billy Wilder, The Manchurian Candidate, the original version, directed by John Frankenheimer, and Moscow on the Hudson, directed by Paul Mazursky. Even though they take a lot of shots at communism, they take more of the Romeo and Juliet approach, not the young lovers thing, but the A Plague on Both of Your Houses approach. And so
I guess you could also throw White Nights into that mix too, couldn't you?
I don't love that movie as much as other people do.
I'm just saying thematically.
No, but I'm saying the dance sequences make it worth watching. Oh, but yeah, the rest of the movie, I'm not as crazy about. But, you know, to find good movies that do get at just how bad a system of government, communist governments were, you either have to go to American independent movies like The Unbearable Lightness of Being, directed by Phil Kaufman, or Before Night Falls, directed by Julian Schnabel, both of which were mostly not filmed in the U.S., but in other countries, or look to other films from other countries that were anti-communist and good movies, not just propaganda movies. Things like The Confession by Costa Gavras, a movie I mentioned in passing several episodes ago, Boat People, directed by Anne Huey, Children of the Revolution, an Australian movie directed by Peter Duncan, which is flawed by a somewhat cartoonish performance by F. Murray Abraham as Joseph Stalin, but is redeemed otherwise by the rest of the cast, including Judy Davis, Sam Neill, and Jeffrey Rush. And then also Shoo Shoo the Scent Down Girl, directed by Joan Shen, 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, directed by Christian Mungiu. Although I'm not entirely familiar with the work of Andrzej Wajda. The little I've seen has been very critical of the Polish communist government, including Katyn. And then also Paweł Pawłukowski made a couple of good ones with Ida and Cold War. And then the comedy The Death of Stalin, directed by Armando Iannucci, and the movie under discussion now, The Lives of Others. I happen to think it is a very good movie, as well as being a very smart movie about people having to live in under a communist government, particularly under a very effective and tyrannical secret police. What did you think, Claude? Did you like this movie, or did you feel it was a harangue?
No, I really liked it, actually. And the other thing that kind of impressed me about it is, you know, a lot of times when you get into this, you know, communist bad kind of storyline, is you get these scenes with the troops marching in and a lot of people like barking orders and, you know, that kind of thing, as if to just like really, really, you know, emphasize the fact that these are terrible people and they're out to ruin lives and whatever. This is a very quiet film. This film is practically ASMR in its nature. It's like everybody speaking quietly, even when the cops are coming in. It's not like they come blasting through the doors and like and breaking everything up. It's like even as they're taking the apartment apart, it's still kind of a, like they're doing it very peacefully. I mean, yeah, they're cutting up his cushions and, you know, taking the books out of the bookshelf and whatever else. And I do like that little bit of comedy at the end. In the unlikely event that we've done any damage, you can submit this thing. And yeah, but it's all on a very, very like low key kind of situation. It's kind of neat in that respect.
ASMR,
yeah, it's a autonomous sensory meridian response, and it's basically a sensation that people get like when somebody is whispering or speaking softly or certain sounds, and it kind of gives you that little tingle in the back of your head. That's called ASMR.
Okay, you learn something new every day.
It's worth looking up on YouTube. It's just kind of, it's an interesting phenomenon, actually.
So I'm going to get into the style of the movie, which includes how quiet it is.
Once again, I have jumped your gun. Okay, go ahead.
But first, I want to mention that one of the inspirations for the movie was just as in the Book of Exodus and probably other books in the Bible afterwards, when Moses has led his people out from Egypt, and they face hardship, and they're kind of thinking, oh, why are we going through all this hardship? Egypt wasn't so bad. Why don't we go back to that old way of life? In the 1990s, after the Cold War ended, and Eastern Bloc countries had to try and embrace a different form of government, as well as Russia, without much help from us, but that's another story. You know, there was a lot of, things weren't really that bad when we had communist rule types of people talking. And there were actually a couple of movies that seemed in the vein of that type of thinking. And I have to say ahead of time, to be fair, I have not watched these movies. I'm thinking of movies like Goodbye Lenin, which is about a family that tries to prevent their dying matriarch from finding out that the Cold War is ended because they fear it's going to be too big a shock for her. And then another movie called Son and Ali. Both of these are German movies. And one of the inspirations for von Donnersmarck was the fact that he wanted to show that, yes, life in East Germany really was that bad back then. And setting it during 1984, which not only may be a conscious or unconscious parallel or intended to draw a parallel to George Orwell's famous novel, even though the novel is about totalitarian governments in general and not just communist governments. But again, that's a longer discussion. But also because 1984 was in the middle of the 80s when it looked like the U.S. and the Soviet Union were no longer practicing détente, but at actual loggerheads, and things in the Eastern Bloc countries were arguably at their worst as far as the repressive governments went. So through a lot of methods, von Donnersmarck was trying to convey the message that, you know what, this was a dictatorship and a lot of good people got hurt. And a lot of people were afraid of speaking up because if they knew that if they did speak up, bad things were going to happen to them. So the von Donnersmarck, I think, does a good job of showing that. And again, as you mentioned, it's not done in a very heavy-handed manner, which it would be if this was a U.S. film. But it's done in the quiet ways, such as Weasler, who, by the way, is played by Ulrich Mueh, who I want to get back to in just a second, when he's checking off the student's name who questioned his methods at the beginning of the movie, or the way that the his boss, Grubitz, who's played by Ulrich Tukur, who some people may remember for the remake of Solaris, directed by Steven Soderbergh, when he encounters the lower-ranking officer telling a joke about the government, you know, and when Wiesler spies the neighbor who sees what he's doing in Dreiman's apartment and warns her what will happen if she says anything, you know, all of that is done very quietly. Wiesler doesn't raise his voice at all. You know, he just states things matter-of-factly. Grubitz even tries to make a little joke about the lower ranking officer saying a joke. So there's no mustache twirling in this movie, with one possible exception, and that being Minister Hempf, who's played by Thomas Tieme, who I'm also going to get back to in a moment. But then again, his mustache twirling is less about this being a totalitarian government and more about the fact that this is yet another government official who thinks that being in power means that he gets to abuse women
right
whenever he wants to. So again, all very effectively done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think, unless I wasn't paying attention, that you mentioned the performance of Sebastian Koch as Dreiman. I mean, he did a fantastic job throughout this film.
I was getting to him as well. Remember, I was talking about the fact that this is quietly done. Mm-hmm. Now, another effective part of the style of the movie is that that von Donnersmarck, along with the cinematographer Hagen Bogdanski and the production designer Silke Bjor, deliberately avoided using a lot of blue or red, especially red, so that, one, he wanted to capture the look of the time, to make it look as if we were planted right in 1984 East Germany, but also so that the rare uses of red, such as that red fingerprint that Dreimann notices, stand out all the more. And then von Donnersmarck also shot locations that most resembled what things would have looked like in East Germany at the time. And just as with The Conversation, which was another big influence on this movie, you know, we get a lot of look at the technology that's getting used in eavesdropping on Dreimann and his wife, or his girlfriend rather, and all of that equipment is actual Stasi equipment from the 1980s that was used by them at the time. And the archives that Dreimann goes to visit, I believe, is the actual archive center where they held the archives, though I'm not 100% clear about that. But I do know that the locations used were ones that were made to resemble the time period, or that looked like the time period from back then. And the equipment was from back then. So all of that, as well as the fact that von Donnersmarck and Bogdansky shoot it in somewhat of a, not documentary style, but somewhat of a naturalistic style to emphasize it, how realistic this is supposed to be, don't do anything particularly flashy with the camera work or anything like that, you know, helps you get immersed in the world that this is happening in, so that even if they may have made up a couple of details here and there, this actually feels real.
Yeah, I think most, if not all of the shots, not all of them, but most of the shots are basically eye level. So you're in the room with the characters, and the only time you're getting something like an overhead view or something like that is it's a point of view shot. You know, you're kind of looking over somebody's shoulder, or you're seeing what they're seeing. So you get like the view through the through the binoculars that a character is using early on in the movie. You're getting the view through the peephole that the neighbor has going on, stuff like that. There's, as you say, nothing especially flashy here.
Now, another way that von Donnersmarck was able to get realism out of this movie is a lot of the cast, including Miwe, had lived in East Germany before this movie. And Miwe, in particular, had said that his first wife actually spied on him. Now, she sued him for libel about that, and he did have to pay damages. But nevertheless, he had a file on him, as did many other people in this movie. So just like Casablanca,
I was just thinking about that.
Helped
yeah.
by all of the refugees from Europe who were in the cast and who helped lend a realistic edge to melodrama. So the casting of Miwi and other actors in smaller roles, but still, you know, it helps lend that air of realism to the movie as well. Now, one criticism that came out about this movie was that because the Stasi was so totalitarian and so repressive, that there was no way that one person who was working for them would actually change their mind and start questioning themselves and actually helping out the people that they were supposed to spy on. And since a lot of that criticism comes from people who lived in East Germany at the time, I can only say that is fair. Having said that, A, I think it works as a dramatic device, and we in the U.S. have actually seen that used in a number of movies. I mean, not about totalitarian governments, but the type of thing where a person who is part of a system that they've believed all their lives, suddenly, because of one instance, all of a sudden realizes that maybe that system isn't all that it's cracked up to be. And the other thing comes out with the quote that Claude mentioned in his synopsis for the movie. It's a abridged quote by Lenin, who was apparently listening to Beethoven's Appassionata and decided that he couldn't listen to the music anymore because he needed to concentrate on what he was doing. And so von Donnersmarck, in the commentary on the DVD edition I have, said that basically this movie was asking a question, well, what if Lenin or someone like that actually decided to listen to Appassionata all the way through and was so moved by that piece of music that he decided that it threw everything he thought he knew into question, and he decided not to pursue his line of thinking anymore. And I think that von Donnersmarck does do a good job of illustrating that. A lot of that, of course, is due to Muir, given how, like just about everyone else in here, he does give a very subtle performance. You know that he is someone who is dedicated to a socialist idea of government, because when Grubitz is telling him when they're at the cafeteria that they can perfectly well sit at the officer's table, he chooses to sit with the men, so to speak, because as he says, socialism has to start somewhere. But at the same time, you know, he does believe in using repressive methods. And yet the way he turns from being a strong arm of this repressive government to actively yet quietly working within that government to damage one of its operations so it can't act as effectively as it wants to is very well done.
It is. And, you know, the thing is that I like about this particular character and the way he's handled is that he doesn't really have like a big turning point moment. It's just like a brick and a brick and a brick and a brick, and all of a sudden you've got a wall. You know, it's a very slow process that he goes through, and you really don't know what he's going to do and what's motivating him to do what he's doing. And even when he, you know, realizes that maybe the motivation for monitoring Dreyman is might not be the purest, you know, he kind of sticks with what he's doing and, you know, finds kind of different ways to undermine the system. Because chances are, if he had completely gotten away with it and he didn't get caught, you know, things wouldn't necessarily have changed for him. He might have just moved on to the next subject and continued his ways. It was just that he got slowly invested in this particular person who he could see was, you know, just generally a good party member, and that's the way it goes, and let's leave him alone, and there's no reason why we shouldn't leave him. Oh, there is a reason why we shouldn't leave him alone. Okay, but that's not in keeping with the whole party philosophy. So he thinks he's actually doing a good thing for the party in general. I mean, that's how he's reading it for himself, I think. He's kind of not necessarily casting himself as the hero here, but he's doing something that he thinks is just generally for the good of the party.
And unlike Minister Hampf, who lusts after Krista Maria. You know, while he does have feelings for her, it's more like he worships her. Mm-hmm. So he's not, you know, you do see that he's not solitary as far as woman goes. You know, he has prostitutes come over every night. But again, you know, this is not a love story. This is, you know, a person moved by two people and wanting to help them because, as you say, it's for the good of the party and the good of the country. Now, speaking of Krista Maria, Martina Gadeck, who is the actress who plays Krista Maria, she is one of the two actors in common with this movie and Bader-Meinhof Complex. The other is Thomas Tieme, who plays Minister Hemp. But Gadeck, in the roles that I've seen her in, has played somewhat emotionally fragile characters before. The first big movie, well, first movie that was known to Western audiences that she appeared in was a German movie called Mostly Martha, which was remade a few years later as No Reservations, with Catherine Zeta-Jones playing her role. And she plays a emotionally stunted chef who's not good at any social interaction, is only good in the kitchen, and then finds her life upended when, A, she has to take care of her niece after her sister dies, and then also finds another chef working in her kitchen, but then gets involved with them. And she's very good in that. And American audiences might also know her as a translator in Robert De Niro's underrated spy movie, The Good Shepherd. And again, she's playing someone who's not in that movie. She's playing someone who's got a hidden side there as well. And on the commentary for the DVD, von Donnersmarck calls her the Meryl Streep of Germany. Now, the two movies that I mentioned and Bader-Meinhof Complex are the only movies of hers that I've seen. So I don't know if I can go that far. But what I can say is that she does a very good job taking you through the emotional state of Krista Maria and the volatile nature of that without going over the top.
Yeah, she, you know, and she's got a lot going on, and it very little of it is actually spelled out for us. I mean, we understand she's being harassed by Minister Hemp, and she's kind of have to reconcile that in her relationship with Dreimann and, you know, all that that entails. And even as we get toward the end and it's very tense and they're pulling up the floor and she's kind of looking from person to person and trying to figure out what's her next move. You know, she's kind of understated, and at the same time, she conveys an awful lot. And I really, really like that for her. And even the scene where she first goes to meet with Hemp, and she comes home, and the first thing she does is jump in the shower. And, you know, we've seen this, you know, I hate to call it a trope, but it kind of is, you know, where somebody is sexually assaulted and they go into the shower and they kind of hide there for a while. And she is doing that a little bit. And at the same time, I didn't feel like it's like, oh, we're going to this well again. You know, she just conveyed it in a little bit of a different way that allowed me to feel for her just a little bit more.
Right. Now, going back to Mui for a second before I move on to the other three main members of the cast, if you only knew him as the ineffective husband in the original version of Funny Games, directed by Michael Haneke, then you'd be quite surprised at how good he is playing the stiff-necked at first Wiesler. But anyway, now let's talk about the guy who is the other common actor with this in Bader-Meinhof Complex, Thomas Tieme, who plays Minister Hamp. The weird thing about his performance, even though, as I stated, there is a little bit of mustache twirling there of the guy who believes that power is an aphrodisiac and can therefore get away with woman anything, in his own twisted way, he does have feelings for Christa Maria. And he's able to suggest that, especially in the scene after the wall has come down, when Dreyman's play is being performed in a united Germany for the first time, and Dreyman can't take it. He walks out and he sees Hanff in the library, and Hanff correctly guesses that it was too much for him. Mm-hmm. And he confesses to Dreyman, you know, I couldn't watch it either. And while, you know, it could be that he felt that no one could live up to the standards of the East German actors, there's the tiniest hint in his voice that maybe he was thinking of Christa Maria as well, and that affected him too much that he couldn't watch. So, yes, in a very twisted way, he does have feelings for her, and that does complicate what could otherwise be a buffoonish character.
Yeah, actually, that's kind of the way I took it too, was that you know, he kind of had Christa Maria in that role. He'd kind of locked into her, and he would have liked to have seen her again, but clearly that's not going to happen. I didn't view that as well, you know, just things were better in the old days. This was really a you know, I miss her too kind of situation. And I think Dreyman kind of handled it well, actually. Given that little bit of complication. And also, I think earlier in the film where she misses the appointment with him, and he tells the driver, is like, I want to know where she is. And I think there's an element of jealousy there. Is he a little bit possessive in that particular sense? Is like, is she fooling around with some other minister? You know, like that kind of situation. Like, did somebody else get to her? Which turns out not to be the case, of course.
Right. And of course, Koch, who would later team up with von Donnersmarck in his most recent movie, Never Look Away, which also takes place partly in East Germany, and where he's playing a very different character, actually more of a villainous character in that one. But he too is a subtle actor from the things that I have seen him in, which include Bridge of Spies, the one American movie that he was in. He was on Homeland, though I don't remember if he was in the first season, because I only watched the first season. And he's in a very good movie looking at where he plays a Nazi, actually, Paul Verhoeven's Black Book. But in all of those, you know, you've got this great subtle performance out of him. And here as well, you know, the way that he realizes that Wiesler, though he doesn't know who he is yet, has been working behind the scenes to sort of save his life. That's handled very well. And Ulrich Tukur, who, in addition to Solaris, he and Koch were also in Amen, another Nazi-themed movie directed by Costa Gavras. And Tukur, again, played an actual Nazi who, believe it or not, was on the side of good in John Rabe, a docudrama about the Nazi who improbably helped to try and save several thousand Chinese when the Japanese invaded Manchuria in the 1930s. But he also plays someone who, you know, while he certainly relishes the authority he has, doesn't go over the top with that. And when he's trying to figure out if Wiesler is lying to him or telling truth, you know, he conveys that very subtly as well.
Yeah, he really wants to believe his friend, you know, and it's just unfortunately for him, is like, yeah, something's just not quite adding up here. And, you know, he's almost like forcing himself to look a little bit deeper because this is just something not quite right with this picture. And if I could go back to Sebastian Koch for just a minute, it's just, again, that subtlety. And again, he's one of those guys who does a lot with just a little bit, so that when he has, you know, what for this film would be a big reaction, it has an effect on you as the viewer. And I'm thinking first when he discovers that his friend has committed suicide, and then at the end when he goes to, you know, ask for his file, and he figures, like, and there are other people in there and they've got their file and it's a file, and he asks for his file and they bring out like a dozen of them on a cart and wheel the thing out to him, and just the way his eyes go wide is like, holy cats. Because even at the point where he is going through his apartment and pulling out all the wires, okay, he realizes, yes, indeed, I was certainly bugged, but he still has no idea of the magnitude of the surveillance that he was under until he sees all these folders come out.
Right. Now, one last thing I want to mention before we wrap this up. While Passionata was a big influence for von Donnersmarck in writing this movie, I think in the commentary mentioned something about the fact that he felt that it would be too on the nose or something like that, which is why it's not used in the movie. Instead, the theme song that ends up being the title of Dreiman's book, Sonata for a Good Man, was written by the film's composer, Gabriel Yared. And his music is, like the rest of the movie, very low-key, but at the same time, powerful. And when the piece of music, Sonata for a Good Man, plays and it moves Wiesler to tears, you do believe that that would happen, because that is a powerful piece of music.
It absolutely is, and it's worth noting that Koch actually played it himself. That was not dubbed in music.
Okay. Is there anything else that you want to mention before we wrap this up?
I have exactly one interesting little piece of trivia, yes. There's a little bit of foreshadowing in this film, okay, that you might not realize. One of the things that they mentioned a couple of times in the film as he's writing the article about the lack of statistics for suicide is, he says, East Germany, at the time they stopped collecting suicide data, had more suicides than any other European country except for Hungary, right? Mm-hmm. Laszlo, which is the name of that's the code word for the operation, is a Hungarian name. So they actually set you up for that.
Yes, that's right. Because, you know, the great cinematographer Laszlo Kovács came from Hungary. So that's it for part one. And coming up immediately after for part two will be jumping back in history, but jumping a couple years ahead movie-wise, to talk about the Bader-Meinhof complex.
Yes, we're going to be also jumping to the other side of the Berlin Wall. That's coming up right away in your podcast feed, so stick around.